welcome into ESPN FC. Kay Murray, Stevie Nicol and Shaka Hislop here with you. A little later on, we'll be hearing from Rob Palmer as we talk La Liga, but we will start with ESPN reports that Man City have lodged a £100 million bid for Jack Grealish. Some compelling numbers here when you look at his stats from last season. 10th in dribbles, 3rd in chances created, 1st in fouls won. And this was despite only playing 26 games. In fact, in the last two seasons, he's had more chances created than Kevin De Bruyne. And for more on this topic, let's welcome in now Ian Dark. Ian, it seems that City are stepping up their intentions to get this player. Can you see it going ahead? 100 million is a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, particularly in this COVID crisis. But I think this is a deal that's been boiling for quite a while now. You could read the tea leaves a little bit when Aston Villa made such a bold bid. It didn't work to get Emile Smith Rowe, creative number 10 type player from Arsenal. That didn't work. They got Emi Buendia from Norwich City, who's another creative spark. That suggested to me that Villa kind of knew they might lose Jack Grealish, despite the fact he signed a 5-year contract with them just about this time last year. But I like Grealish. I mean, the fans love him. He holds the ball. He dribbles at defences. He makes things happen. He's strong. He plays with his, he's like an old-time player with his socks kind of down a half-mast, the floppy hair. So I think he would be a big hit if he moved to Manchester City. And it might be a bit frightening, really, their lineup with him in it, especially if they got Harry Kane as well.
Yeah, they are frightening figures, though, aren't they, Stevie? £100 million. Is he worth it?
I don't know whether I would pay £100 million for him. I think he's a great player, yes. But, you know, stepping up and doing it for Aston Villa and then moving up a gear to Manchester City is a different ballgame. Let's not forget, he couldn't get in the England team. So you've got a 100 million player who can't get in the England team. I'm not so sure he's worth that. But the fact is, it looks like they're going to pay it. And they're going to get a guy who's something they don't have. You know, all the players they have pretty much are about passing and moving, little one-twos, getting half a yard in the final third of the field. He goes at players. He goes past players. And so he does give them something different. And as I said, he's a great player. He gives you something different, makes you better.
We've been asking the panel, Shaka, if he starts. It's obviously a big fee. Does he start for City?
I think if they break their transfer fee in this manner, yes, he starts. But that's not a given. 3 years ago, Manchester City did exactly that with Riyad Mahrez in spending $60 million, breaking their own transfer record. And he wasn't straight into the starting lineup. That being said, City have an outstanding midfield. My concerns with Grealish is so much of the ball has to go through him when he's on the park. If you have him and Kevin De Bruyne, I just feel that as good as Grealish is, as highly as I think of him, despite this transfer record, if De Bruyne is on the park, he is the main focus of City's thrust through midfield. And so where does that leave Jack Grealish? And that, for me, again, I had those same concerns around Riyad Mahrez going to the Etihad, and look how well that worked out. So maybe Pep Guardiola makes this work. But right now, it just seems a little bit of an odd fit for me.
It comes down to mental strength for Jack Grealish. Because he knows he's getting the ball. When he steps on the field with Villa, with England, it was the same.
Yeah.
He gets the ball. Does he have the mental strength to figure out and accept that it's not just him that they're trying to get the ball to? If he does that, then he'll fit him fine. But if he doesn't, then it's going to be a bit of a problem.
As you say, Steve, though, that is exactly what I thought of Riyad Mahrez. And exactly what I'm saying about Jack Grealish now is what I said about Riyad Mahrez 3 years ago. And that has worked wonderfully well. But it doesn't change where I sit right now on that.
What do you think, Ian? Does the way he plays suit City?
I think the way he plays suits anybody. He's the most fouled player by miles in the Premier League. He's going to win a lot of free kicks, apart from anything else. I think he's going to fit really wherever he plays. He's got to that kind of level now. He's in his mid-20s. I get what Shaka's saying, because De Bruyne really is the main hub, the man who makes things happen for Manchester City. So there would have to be some adjustments, but I can't believe that Jack Grealish would not enhance a team. It's interesting you put that projected Manchester City up there without Raheem Sterling, who did star for England and was ahead of Grealish in the England pecking order. So nobody's guaranteed a place, but look how many games City have to play. They're fighting on four fronts every season, so they can rotate those forward players that they have. Everybody's going to get enough minutes in there. Yeah, I think Grealish would play, as you've got in there, up front, wide on the left-hand side. That's usually where Foden is best, and usually where Sterling is best. Mahrez is better on the right-hand side, and I think it's pretty much an open secret. They're looking for a proper number nine to go through the middle, and the candidates there are pretty obvious.
Yeah, so who would be more important if it was to only be one? Would it be Jack Grealish or would it be Harry Kane?
I think Grealish is the more doable deal at the moment, because this fee that Spurs have put out there, well, they haven't put it out there officially, but I think the reporters have cottoned onto it. It's been leaked. £160 million. I mean, that's crazy money where we are. It's almost don't touch money. So I think Pep Guardiola said earlier on in the summer, we can't afford that kind of money. Of course, that's just a negotiating ploy as well. Manchester City have got very, very deep pockets. We know that.
And we know that Pep Guardiola will have a plan for any player that he's looking at and any player he wants to bring in. So what is his plan for Grealish? Or what would it be?
More quality. He already has quality. He already has an 11 without Grealish that will start as favourites for the Premier League. So the more talent he can have at his disposal, then, as Darky said, they're going to be playing a lot of games. So for him, it's fantastic. He can make a change, and he knows it's not going to affect the quality. So, Pep, yeah, just keep bringing in as many players as you want. I don't care what you spend, just keep them coming.
Speaking of big money moves, I mean, it's half of that, but it's still big when you consider it's Ben White for $50 million to Arsenal. It's official. We know that's actually happened now. It's more money than Rafael Varane has cost to Manchester United. So, Ian, can the $50 million price tag be justified for Ben White?
It's a big fee because, remember, a year ago, he'd never kicked a ball in the Premier League. He'd been at Leeds United when they were promoted from the Championship. Leeds made three separate bids after that season because they wanted to keep him. Brighton said, no, we've seen how good he is now. They put him straight in their team. He played anywhere in the back three or back four if they ever tried that, usually a back three. He even played as a defensive midfield player. He then made the England squad. Didn't get a kick of the ball in the Euros, but I think this kid is classy. I think you could see all through last season, he's a future England player. So I think Arsenal fans should be very, very pleased because that is a signing, I think, that really does improve them. I like him a lot. Yeah, it is big money, but it's worth it. I think it's a good signing.
Where does he rank among the league's best centre-backs now in the Premier League?
Geez, that's a good question. I mean, we haven't seen him tested at the various, very highest level, as Ian points out, Leeds and then Brighton, and Brighton their own struggles in the league. But he stood out for them. Standing out for Brighton is a totally different ask for standing out for Arsenal or, to your point, the league's best. So that's where the uncertainty comes. But there's no question that he's a player that, or in a position, at the very least, that Arsenal needs. Coming from a club and at a fee that Arsenal are now shopping with. They aren't competing with Manchester United for the Rafael Varans. There's a premium to signing English players. Always has been. That's nothing new. So I think the comparison to Varane's transfer fee is an unfair one. But we'll see. It's still an unknown quantity at this level. So maybe drawing those comparisons between Ben White and, for argument's sake, let's say a John Stones, who came with that same qualities of a ball-playing centre-back, yet struggled to settle in at Manchester City, then all of a sudden last season had arguably the best season of his career. Arsenal don't have that time to play with, but similar mould, in my opinion.
Do you put him up there with the best in the league in terms of centre-backs, Stevie?
I would have had no problem if he had started at centre-back for England in the Euros. No problem. He's 23. Listen, you don't get anything for nothing these days. And if Kyle Walker's 50 million, what, three years ago, then Ben White's 50 million. He's got 10 years ahead of him.
If you started him as centre-back for England, in front of who? From the,
no, I said if he had started.
Right.
No, clearly you play Stones and Maguire.
Right.
But I'm just saying, had they had injury problems, I would have absolutely no hesitation and wouldn't have thought twice if he was in the team. So for 50 million, I don't think it's way over the top at all.
Ian, do you think that his signing moves back Arsenal back into Champions League contention?
That's a big call
because they're a mid-table side. They need more. They need more than that. But I think this is a statement, I think, from Arsenal, who have lagged behind and are going further and further away from the top four. I think they're making a bit of a statement here that says, look, we mean a bit more business here. We need to get back in touch. And I think paying out £50 million for one of the best young defenders in the country, I think that says that.
This same crew will be back with us for Extra Time answering your questions. Don't forget, you can always catch it over on YouTube. Just make sure you subscribe to ESPN FC.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus have issued a joint statement about the Super League, saying that the three welcome today's court decision, enforcing with immediate effect UEFA's obligation to unwind the actions taken against all European Super League founding clubs. We have the duty to address the very serious issues facing football. UEFA has established itself as the sole regulator, exclusive operator and unique owner of rights of European football competitions. This monopolistic position in conflict of interest is damaging football and its competitive balance. As shown by ample evidence, financial controls are inadequate and they have been improperly enforced. Our aim is to keep developing the Super League project in a constructive and cooperative manner. Rob Palmer joins us now to talk a little bit about this. And there's lots more to it than this, Rob, but this is the statement that's been released by the three clubs together, and it seems they are standing firm on their plans for a Super League, even though it's still just the three of them.
Yeah, sometimes maybe in football and in politics, presidents don't like to be told they're wrong or to admit defeat, do they? And this is certainly the case. It seems with these clubs, they're like a dog with a bone. They won't give it up. I've got the dictionary out. Monopolistic. I'm not quite sure what that means. Does that mean that you're going to form your own league and then only invite certain teams to come in it? That seems like a monopoly to me. But they won't give it up. But it seems that the English teams, they appear to need to have on board. And the French teams and the Italian teams, apart from Juventus, have all given up the chase. And it just looks like they're just trying to wiggle a bit of elbow room when it comes to the meetings with the UEFA, when it comes to TV deals and what happens with the league and who gets the invite to play in the Champions League. And I think we're just watching politics being played out. Interestingly, in the court in Madrid, surprise, surprise, a Madrid court falling on the side of Real Madrid. And now they take it, is it, to the European Court of Human Rights, which is in Luxembourg. Not a lot of football goes on there.
Three clubs still in it, releasing a joint statement, as you saw, to welcome the move. And the case is now to be assessed, as Rob said, by the European Court of Justice. And as Rob said, and I'm wondering if you think the same, they're sounding a bit like a dog with a bone here. Although they have had it ruled in their favour so far. And the other nine clubs that did pull out will not be penalised as they were going to be.
Let me say, I have no problem with the court saying that the clubs who try to form the Super League shouldn't be penalised by UEFA going forward. But there's so much in that statement that I disagree with and wonder how do Barcelona, with a straight face, put their names to a statement that says UEFA's financial controls are inadequate. Barcelona, given the position that they're in right now. And while I understand the sentiment that UEFA has that monopolistic control of football in Europe, and they're right, I think it's needed. Where if UEFA don't have that right, if there isn't that monopoly around top-level football in Europe, where do you stop? Does FIFA not have that right to have a monopoly over world football? Does the Premier League not have that same monopolistic right over English football? Can we say the same about Spain? Does that then allow Manchester United to compete in the Premier League and form some other league in England that they decide they want to be in with Arsenal and Aston Villa and whoever else they decide because they can win? It's that way because it works. And it works not just in football, it works in every single sport where there's a governing body. So to suggest that that's wrong or needs addressing, I find counterproductive.
But you said monopolistic.
I said it a couple of times.
Must be a word of Shaq, is it?
There you go, Rob. Rob, I want to talk to you a little bit about Real Madrid because in Carlo Ancelotti's presentation, he was repeatedly asked about bringing in possible arrivals and he repeatedly talked about having to actually trim the Real Madrid squad. Now, Diario AS have reported today that he doesn't want a squad any bigger than 22 or 23 players. He wants two players in each position. We know there'll probably be a few players coming up from Castilla that he can use. And these are some of the names that are on the list. Luka Jovic, Isco, Martin Odegaard, Mariano, Rodrigo and Kubo as well. With Jovic, 60 million paid. Five seasons, that was for. No offers for Isco. And I think a big thing here is his annual salary, which is reported to be 8 million a year, that they may even be willing to take a reduced fee for him just to shift some of that salary. So what do you see happening here?
Well, in the dream world, they would get the money they paid for all of those players. They'd put it all in the bank, and then a couple of days later, they'd draw it out and buy Mbappe. But that is the dream world. What they need to do is to try to reclaim some of the ridiculous money they spent in the transfer market, and they haven't got a dividend on in the last few years. And also what they need to do, like Barcelona Football Club, and maybe it's not as bad as Barca, is to reduce the wage bill. But everybody knows at the moment with what 2 weeks to go to the start of the Premier League season and the start of La Liga season, it's a buyer's market. And if you're trying to get rid of somebody, they're going to wait until the very last minute and they're going to make a ridiculous offer and maybe say, well, we'll take him off you for this or we'll pay you a loan fee, but you've got to continue to pay half of the wages. So no president is going to move. There are very few clubs that can afford to pay money in there. And I would imagine a little bit like Barcelona, that most of the players have got a price on their head. Isco, Jovic, Odegaard, Ceballos, Mariana, Odriozola, all players have been recruited in recent years, but all players that seem to have no future at Real Madrid, and they've spent so much money there and they just haven't got anything out of those players. And then you think of Hazard as well, 100 million. If they could get half of that back for him, I think they'd take it tomorrow.
Yeah, a lot of money as well for Mariano. Now, there's some that they see as maybe having a future there, but just not right now. Like Kubo and Rodrigo and Odegaard fall into that category. But it's Jovic, Isco and Mariano that are being talked about as players that they're hoping will bring them money in. But can you see any realistic buyers for these players right now?
Not really, not at the ages as well. You know, Isco's soon to be 30. Jovic came in with a lot of promise. He's not really done it. They loaned him out last year. And Real Madrid, I think I'm right in saying about 35, 38 senior professionals there. What Ancelotti wants to do is get it down to a squad of maybe about 20 players and then allow a pathway for the players who they will have spent a lot of money on to bring them into the Real Madrid youth system and have them on the verges of the first team. They brought several through last year. It has been a revolution there. But if hand on heart, and I'm sure you're going to ask me about Barcelona as well, I can't really see anybody taking those players, certainly not buying them, maybe coming in and taking them on loan and maybe paying them a fraction of the wages just to help Real Madrid out and to put a big name on the, you know, on the team sheet on a Saturday afternoon. But I can't see there being a lot of movement at Real Madrid. And poor old Ancelotti, he doesn't know what his 11 is going to be on the starting weekend of the season. He doesn't know he knows what he'd like to play, but doesn't know if those players are going to be about.
Yeah, because ideally he'd like to have that squad set in place by the time Real Madrid do kick off their first game. Now, you did say that you think I was going to ask you about Barcelona. You are correct, because this from Enrico Cerezo, the Atleti president, who says, with regards to Griezmann, we do not rule anything out, but what we can say is that Griezmann is not an easy signing. It's a difficult operation. I feel like this one's going backwards and forwards, Rob, because it looked as though there was going to be a deal made between the two clubs and some type of pact. Then it said that had broken down. And this now from the Atleti president suggests maybe there is something that could happen.
They're very clever, aren't they, at Atletico Madrid? They are the only team probably in La Liga that don't need to make any signings, don't need to sell anybody, don't need to shift anything. They can name the same 11 and benches last year. And for me at the moment, they're favourites to win La Liga because they have certainty. The only manager, Simeone, who knows exactly who he's got available to him on the opening weekend of the season. Barca in turmoil, Real Madrid in turmoil as well. And you had to feel for Antoine Griezmann, I suppose in some ways, but then you have to look back a couple of years when Griezmann had that. There was an Instagram video put out and this grand unveiling to say he was staying in Atletico Madrid. And then a year later, he departed and went to Barcelona. And it's not quite worked out for him. He has scored goals, but as anybody would be, he's in the shadow of Lionel Messi and has been in his time at Barcelona. And he's probably Barcelona's most saleable asset. And also, he's got such a heavy wage packet that comes in. Does he still get paid on a Friday afternoon? I'm not sure. But whenever he does get paid, and what they need to do, Barcelona, as we all know, is do their accounts and shift his wage off their wage bill every week. And I think there are a lot of teams that would take him, but I don't think in the current economical climate with what's gone on in the world in the last year that there are too many takers for him, maybe in a year's time. But it's really difficult at Barcelona because they need to get some spare pegs in the changing room to allow the new signings to come in.
Yeah, that famous decision video didn't quite turn out the same for him as it did for LeBron James going to the Miami Heat. But let's talk a little bit about Barcelona. Is there anything different at the moment from us two speaking last week about this situation? It seems there hasn't been too much movement other than this from the Atleti president.
Let me have a look at my notes. No. Umtiti's still there. Nobody's coming for Brathwaite. Pjanic's still there. Neto, the backup goalkeeper. They might get a few dollars for. None of them have moved on. They're all remaining firm. They're all saying that they're proud to be Barcelona players and they'll see out their contract. And of course, that is their right. And nobody's come in. No movement. It's like watching chess at the moment, watching Barcelona on a daily basis. I check all of the newspapers and the websites, and it is like watching a chess game that's just stalemate between the president. The coach has got no say in it. That's more than football. The players, and probably more notably, the players' agents.
If you're Barcelona, the only thing you're clinging on to is everybody trying to be clever? Are they all just hanging off to the last second so they can get a sweeter deal? Mm. That's what they're hoping for. Because if teams are not thinking that way, what are they going to do? Yeah. How are they going to get Messi? As Rob said, has Messi got a peg? I don't think he has right now.
Yeah, they've not got much time as well to get that salary cap in check. And no doubt we'll be checking back on this very topic next week, but we are 1 week closer then to the kickoff of La Liga. Anyway, keep up to date with all the latest transfer talk on our website, ESPN.com. Search ESPN FC and you'll be able to see all the latest news. Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at electricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's electricebikes.com. Last night, the US and Mexico advanced to the Gold Cup final. For more on that, here's Sebastian Salazar and Hercules Gomez in Las Vegas.
Thank you very much, Kay. Yeah, Las Vegas, just over 48 hours from hosting the 2021 edition of the Gold Cup final, which, as we now know, will, of course, feature the United States and Mexico. Great to be coming to you live from ESPN's Las Vegas studios, Herc, in your own hometown. You are beloved here, I have to say.
A little.
So than anywhere else that I've seen.
Well, that's not very difficult, but yeah, I'll take it.
We got our dream final, USA-Mexico, though there were definitely some moments last night where it was nervous. You thought we might get a Qatar-Canada final. Let's get to the highlights. We'll start with the US and Qatar from the Q2 down in Austin. This was really, Herc, like one-way traffic early on in this game, 19th minute. Matt Turner, one of his many calls into action.
Yeah, this is difficult for Matt Turner because it takes a deflection off of James Sands here, and it's so difficult. He's going one way, has to go the other, and unbelievable reaction save.
That was in the 19th minute. Not 2 minutes later, Qatar back on the front foot. Turner, again, the big stop.
Yeah, it should be 0-2 for Qatar. Matt Turner, again, this is difficult because look at the dip on this ball, the trajectory. He doesn't know whether it should come out or not. He stays, ends up being the correct decision, and another reflex save.
This one ends up at the half being 0-0, thanks in large part to the first half heroics of that man, Turner. 52nd minute. Lots of discussion leading into this. Would Daryl Dike get the start? He does, and this a big chance he couldn't finish.
Yeah, but for a second, concentrating on Matthew Kloppy and this delicate ball.
We love it.
Little nice, delicate, weighted pass with the left foot. And Daryl Dike, I know the goalkeeper comes out and makes himself big, but you have to put that away.
Crazy how quickly things can change, right? Because then a minute later, at the other end, Qatar on the break, and we get a penalty call. Well, actually, at first, we don't get a penalty call. We go to VAR, and then the penalty is given. Herc, what did you think? Because this one divided opinion.
No, that's a penalty.
But James Sands gets a little touch on the ball. He does.
No, he gets touch on the player first, and then he gets...
No, I mean that right there. First ball, then touch. Look at you. Your anti-American ways, Herc. Look right here. The touch first. You're blind. No.
As a defender, you can't just whip a leg out there in the box.
Anti-American, anti-defender ways. That's what you're doing right there.
Maybe. How about this? Give him the business, Kellen Acosta. Give him the business.
Have we seen this before from Kellen Acosta, putting on the old delay tactics? Where, maybe, where have I seen where, this before? USA, it? Mexico.
Oh, there
yeah, that's
it is.
Right.
A little CONCACAF, a taste of the CONCACAF medicine for the Qataris. They're new here, but they'll soon understand in this region that'll happen.
So up comes the penalty and over the bar. Something between a Panenka and a shank.
Yeah, I don't know what you're trying to do here.
Do we credit Turner here for kind of holding?
You credit Acosta, yep. Turner for holding, but ultimately that's just a bad shot.
All right, so 86th minute. Here's your game winner for the U.S. Nicholas Gioacchini, one of the subs. Tejiasi Zardes, another one of the subs.
Yeah, it's Gioacchini here. You got to give him probably 80, 90% of that goal. Watch the little drag. He notices a defender already on the ground. The second defender doesn't push up to him, so he drags the ball to his left. And then presence of mind, outside of the foot, finds Jose Zardes. And look at that, in your face.
Greg Berhalter letting a fourth official know what he thinks about the goal there from Jose Zardes. We should note Greg did apologize after the match for that as we take a look at the match statistics here. The possession suggests that the U.S. were in control of this match, but Herc, watching it, especially that first half where I believe they were outshot 13-3, the U.S. were really hanging on for dear life throughout large stretches of this game.
Very large stretches. Possession, we knew that was going to happen, Seb.
Did you think Qatar would be as dangerous as they were throughout that whole game?
Absolutely.
Wow.
We covered it. We said that Qatar would give you the ball. They will concede possession to you, and they would rub-a-dope you. We actually said that term on our show, and that's exactly what they did. They gave the U.S. men's national team a false sense of security with the ball. And for the first time, players that we raved about for their security, like James Sand, players that we said had a great tournament, like Shaq Moore, felt the nerves. A very young team. I won't get tired of speaking of how novice this team is in big moments. But they keep winning, right?
Exactly.
But still, it's still players that 12 of them prior to this tournament had never played a single minute at the senior national team level, and it showed against Qatar.
So you can complain about the performance, fair enough, but you can't complain about the result, right? This is a C team getting a win against the champions of the Asian Confederations, A team.
Yeah.
That's a big, big result for Greg Berhalter. If I was going to question one thing from this game, Herc, it's something that we questioned with the women's national team before in Vlatko Andonovski. This game was screaming for an adjustment right from the first half.
Yeah.
You sense the U.S. were not on the front foot.
Right.
Did you
right.
feel like that adjustment ever came, other than the exception of one, I would say, the subs? Because you can say Greg Berhalter's subs made a big difference.
Because at halftime, I thought we would see Jesse Sardes. I thought we would see Christian Roldan, who had proven to be sparks before in this tournament. But at half, he gave his team another 15 minutes to...
And Qatar was really better for that start of the second half, weren't they?
Well, Qatar was better for long stretches of this game. Yeah. Honestly, Matt Turner has an off day. This game's over at halftime. It's that simple. But it's very difficult to win games with a young group, and even more so difficult to win 1-0 games. So difficult to hold that lead, to not break, to not even when you're bending, to not break. But they did a good job. They did a good job in weathering the storm and learning how to suffer. But I will reiterate, very young team, and young teams, no matter what level, need to experience this to build that character. Now, say what you will, but you're going to go face Mexico in a final.
We'll talk about it more on our show, but quick answer from you. Who starts the final in that number 9 spot, Dike or Zardes?
No, Jesse Zardes.
Got to be?
Yeah, because Daryl Dike, maybe it's
missed
confidence.
Opportunity.
Maybe it's the confidence, but also maybe it's that shoulder. He definitely looks like he's been laboring and been favoring, and it's been affecting his movement, and affecting the way he can use his body. So if you're Greg Berhalter, who already has a penchant for trusting players, Jesse Zardes is your guy.
So U.S. beats Qatar in the first semifinal. That match played in Austin. The second semifinal then played in Houston. between Mexico and Canada. This one a little bit of a slower start to the game, I might say. 42nd minute here. Tecatito. Corona going to be brought down in the box. And actually, I shouldn't say slow start. Really, Canada were by far the better team until this point.
Yeah, different moments throughout this game. A lot of waves, roller coaster rides for
definite
Mexican
pen here, right?
Yeah, you just can't go to ground there. You give them an out. Tecatito Corona is never getting to that ball. An easy call.
Orbelín Pineda steps up, takes his time, makes us all nervous, but that is cool, isn't it?
This is strange. It's a cool finish, but you would have not pegged Orbelín Pineda to be the guy taking that shot.
Special moment, too, as he goes to celebrate with Jonathan Dos Santos. His father passed earlier in the day. Canada here in the 57th minute. Buchanan, good finish.
Yeah, and he was one of the players I knew would give Mexico fits. You can't give this guy time and space. And look, he gets his head up in the box, does Carlos Salcedo in. Far post finish, silky and as smooth as you'd like.
You'd see that kid in Europe soon if the Revs can't hold on to him. 63rd minute, Marc-Anthony Kay fouls Tecatito. It looks like he's out of the box, or at least well on his way out of the box. Upon further review, Herc, he is in the area.
Oh, this is difficult for me.
What do you mean?
You just said
clear.
He's well on his way out of the box.
But he's in the area.
Is it clear and obvious? I mean, we're here arguing about it. But look at this. Carlos Salcedo. Orbelín Pineda took the first. Where's Funes Mori? Carlos Salcedo takes the second. Why? The nerves got to the defender, who's never really taken big moment penalty kicks like that. And, well, there you go.
So just about 45 seconds after the missed penalty, Eric Gutierrez here called for the foul. Yeah, he only gets a yellow. You think it should have been more?
Absolutely.
Really?
Comes over the top of the ball, onto the opponent. Eustaquio, I mean, he's lucky he didn't break him. Look at this. 100% a red card. 100% has to be out of the game. Eustaquio lucky that he wasn't seriously injured.
And that would have reduced Mexico to 10 men. Obviously had a huge impact. Ninth minute. That's right. Ninth minute of added time. Ache Ache from Rodolfo Pizarro.
Ache Ache, one of the most veteran players, one of the most important players on this team. Pizarro coming on, making a difference. People forget about how important he's been to Tata Martino, but look at Ache Ache and where he goes and celebrates. Goes and celebrates with Jonah Dos Santos, whose father passed away earlier that day.
That's right. Of course, Jonah Dos Santos' father, Zizinho, a great player in his own right, played many years in the Mexican League, the father of Jonah and Gio Dos Santos. There's the final match stats. Mexico well in control, according to the numbers anyway, but this game a lot like U.S. and Qatar. You know, if you're Canada, you probably leave this match feeling like you got the raw end of the deal. You deserve more. Maybe you deserve to win.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, look at how Canada got into this game. Alfonso Davies not in the tournament. Yep. Jonathan David not in the tournament. Yep. Ayo Aquinola, ACL, out of the tournament. Kyle Larin, out of the tournament again. Your next striker up on deck ends up being who?
Cavallini. Yeah,
suspended for this
right.
game. You got other players suspended for this game. And still you give Mexico the business. And by that I mean you lost on two penalty kick goals.
Yep.
Right? You played away.
Well, there were two penalty kick goals. The Ache Ache is not a penalty goal.
Well, you're correct. One goal in open play. And the way that kind of shifts.
So why did Mexico suffer then so much against
Canada?
What? If they're missing all these great players and Canada's not a power, what happened?
I have to give you a little bit of credit here. You said something the other day that made me think, and you're absolutely right. There's a shift in the professional game of how teams play. Mm. We will concede
the international
possession.
Game,
international
right.
Game.
Yep.
We're okay conceding possession because we know the moment they lose it, the spaces are going to be there for us to exploit. And Canada, where their speed is so evident, physically they look like they outmatched the Mexican national team, especially out wide. Richie Larea and Tejan Buchanan were abusing Chaka Rodriguez and on the other side of the Mexico defense. They were just finding open pockets of space. And the physicality in the center of the midfield, Mexico may be an incomplete team from what could be their best version, but still a very good team. But they don't have that physicality in the center of the field.
We still got a couple days till the final. We're going to be out here in Las Vegas producing all sorts of content. So we'll get to our kind of full previews a little bit later on. But we are in Las Vegas, so I looked up the odds. Mexico right now, minus 160 to win this game. That's their odds. That means they're a huge favorite. Is that a fair line for you?
Yeah, I think so. If not more, you have to take in consideration that Mexico will be heavy favorites with the home field advantage.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be heavy favorites the talent level. They'll be heavy favorites because for a lot of these players in the U.S. men's national team, this will be their first game in a final. First final in any professional setting. So any way you want to slice it, Mexico should be favorite. Any way you want to slice it.
That final then, Sunday night from Las Vegas. Allegiant Stadium, the home of your favorite team, Herc, right? The Raiders, you a Raiders fan?
Just win, baby.
The scenes from the Strip. We anxiously await the Gold Cup final, U.S. and Mexico, just a couple days' time. Okay, we send it back to you.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance.
Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
US women are through to the semi-finals of the Olympics after beating the Netherlands in a penalty shootout. And here is how the last four are shaping up. It will be Australia against Sweden and the US taking on Canada. They can only meet Sweden, as you can see there, in the final. 2-2, it finished in regular time and after extra time, but the US winning 4-2 in a penalty shootout. A tense game, lots to discuss. Seb and Herc are now back with us with a special guest to do so.
The US women's national team is into the semifinals at the Tokyo Olympics after a dramatic penalty kick win over the Netherlands earlier this morning. Joining us now, two-time World Cup champion Ali Krieger on the show. Ali, are you cool? Are you calm? Are you collected? How did you survive this morning's game?
I mean, I was so shook this morning, but I've calmed down and I'm definitely cool and collected. But it was a wild game, that's for sure, but so exciting. And I'm so proud of the team to finish up strong and get the job done to move on to the semifinals.
I'm imagining if you're specifically proud of anybody, it's got to be Alyssa Nair, right? She is certainly the hero of the night on this one. Not just, Ali, the three penalty saves, but really the fact that they all come after she made what I think for her level of goalie is like a pretty significant mistake on the second Netherlands goal. It shows her mental fortitude there to not let that affect her and actually from there kind of go on to become the key figure in this match for the U.S.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, she was amazing today making those three important saves of the penalty kicks in order for the U.S. to, you know, continue to have an opportunity to win. And so I think as a goalkeeper, obviously, I talk to Ashlyn about this all the time, that, you know, goalkeepers need to make one or two important saves a game in order to keep their team in it. And that's what she did today. And I'm really, really proud of her to see her progression through this tournament, because I know it hasn't been easy. And the team obviously hasn't been playing the way that they always do. And then obviously Pino stepping up and taking that decisive kick, the winner, just put it right in the top corner. And there was no question about that one.
Ali, I'm looking at the lineup and huge decisions by Vlatko. I mean, there's no Rapinoe, no Alex Morgan, no Kristen Press, no Rose Lavelle. A big decision from the head coach. Walk me through this. What were your initial thoughts?
Yes, obviously, I was surprised as well. You know, I was expecting to see, you know, Pino out there and you know, a really strong starting front line. Not that we didn't have one that started the game, but it just was a surprise to me because Lynn hadn't played all, you know, most of the tournament. And so, obviously, she had a great game today, really was an impact in both of the U.S. goals. And then, obviously, Alex and Pino came in to make a difference in the end. But yeah, I was a bit surprised, but she, Lynn, took her opportunity, did really well, and made a big impact. And that's what the team needed at the time. And so I think it was kind of a refresher for her and the squad, and she did well.
Absolutely. A goal and an assist, a big decision for Vlatko Ananovski. I love the Lynn Williams story. She's kind of the ideal of what the NWSL can do for a player's career. If the NWSL doesn't exist, I don't know that Lynn Williams is in this national team, but she's used that platform, one of the last cuts from the 2019 World Cup team, and here she is making a huge, huge difference in the Olympics. Okay, so Ali, I got to ask you about one of the big talking points before this match with this Dutch team was kind of the trash talk that we were hearing. And maybe trash talk is like too harsh, but from multiple players, quotes that, I mean, I'm sorry, just sounded like supreme confidence going into a World Cup final rematch against, hello, the number one team in the world. I'm super curious to get your reaction to kind of what they say. I'll read you the first quote here. It's from Lika Martins, who actually, as we know, ends up missing the critical penalty, what would have been the game winner. Quote, it is no longer the unbeatable USA that everyone looks up to. We have a lot of respect for them, absolutely, but we think this is the tournament we're going to kick them out in. We're definitely not in awe anymore. There were some similar comments from Danielle van de Donk as well. What was the reaction to this in the locker room. I can't imagine the U.S. women's national team taking this lightly.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, we always step up to the plate thinking that we're going to win and having that winning mentality right from the get, which a lot of teams have been scared of in the past. But I think the biggest takeaway from this tournament so far is that teams are catching up to us and they're no longer scared of the United States. And they can understand that if they bring that, you know, attacking winning mentality and a little compactness in both attacking and defense, both on and off the ball, that they can really match up with us. And I feel like that's kind of those quotes are kind of a reflection of what, you know, how the U.S. women's national team began this tournament. Now, obviously, today, you know, it didn't go Netherlands' way. But, you know, we see that teams in Europe and all over the world are really catching up and figuring it out. And they're doing well. And so I think we do need to continue to work on getting better and growing the game. And it's exciting to see other teams doing just as well, if not better at times.
Okay, one of those teams doing very well is Canada. The U.S. women will play Canada in the semifinal. How big of a threat, Ali, is Canada to the U.S. women?
They're always a threat. They're one of our biggest rivals and have been for many, many years. I think the Canadian national team, they're strong. They also have mental toughness and their willingness to match up with us just tactically, technically, and just to have a battle. I know they're looking forward to this, and I know the obviously U.S. women as well, but Canada always wants to play us, and they always want to be matched up with us, and they think of it as such a good opportunity, and they have one of the best players in the world who's, you know, proven her worth every tournament for years and years, which is Christine Sinclair, who we obviously need to keep an eye on and make sure that we come out to this game right from the start really well and, you know, put them on their heels and get them on their back foot, because I know that they are waiting for this game and probably have been all tournament.
There you go. A backyard brawl in the Olympic semifinal. Ali Krieger, two-time World Cup champion. Thanks so much for the time. Good luck this weekend with Orlando.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And we'll be back on Monday with the next edition of Football Americas, looking back on the Olympic semifinal between the U.S. and Canada.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Just 14 days until La Liga kicks off, and here are the opening fixtures for you. And the countdown continues for us, where every day we are bringing you a La Liga team. Yesterday we brought you Espanyol. Now it's their opponents, Osasuna, which means health in terms of strength in Basque. They finished 11th last season. And let me tell you, to go and play Osasuna as an opposing team, it is one of the most hostile grounds in the league, is El Sadar. If you're going there as a fan, though, well, then it's definitely one of the most passionate. Last year, they celebrated their centenary. And Rob Palmer joining us now to speak about this team. You have covered La Liga since the 90s, Rob. And it was way back in 96 that you had your first trip to Pamplona. And you have a story to tell as well.
Yeah, we just started it, so we headed out with camera crews to go and get a little taste, like you're doing on a daily basis, of the various clubs that we're going to be covering. And I was sent up to Pamplona on a Monday. Osasuna played on the Sunday. We turned up in Pamplona. We turned up at the training ground. It was absolutely dead. It's known for San Fermin, which is like this crazy party that they have for the best part of the week. There was nobody there, and a young manager turned up from Osasuna to tell us that Jamie Pollock, who we should have been interviewing, former Middlesbrough player, wouldn't be turning up for the interview, because the night before he hadn't turned up for the game. Well, they've been doing, they had been training every day at 7 o'clock. So they had a 7 o'clock kickoff. Jamie, an English lad abroad, completely unfamiliar with that kind of training, just set the alarm clock, didn't wake up, didn't turn up for the game, manager suspended him, and he didn't turn up for the interview. The manager, by the way, was a young bloke called Rafa Benitez. Not quite sure what went on to happen to him. But we didn't get Jamie Pollard, good luck, or Rob Ollathorne, who went on to play for Leicester City. And but yeah, it's a wonderful club. I mean, it's you're talking there about the stadium. A pal of mine runs Minnesota United in MLS, and when they were building the new stadium there in St. Paul, I think they had a little look at Osasuna, because it is like almost like a bull ring, as you know. The fans are right on top of the players. It's a proper football ground, proper soccer ground. They are right on there. You can feel it. It's almost sheer size. It's like the inside of a matchbook, see, many times. I don't know what they're going to do this season when it comes to social distancing, because there's no social distancing there. And it generates a wonderful atmosphere. And they are a club who don't have a rich history. They've been in the Champions League. They've got to the final of the UEFA Cup. They've been in the Copa del Rey final as well. But 11th place last year was about right for them. That's kind of where they sit, or that's where they aspire to in our Liga standings.
Yeah, you just saw the pictures there. It's almost like a Highbury. And now they've had renovations as well, and that will allow 6,500 more spectators. So once fans are back, it will be a capacity of around 25,000. My first trip to this stadium, I had a bocadillo, a sandwich, thrown at my head when they realised that I was working for Real Madrid Television. That's how hostile it is. Even the reporters were punished for that. But the fans really are a 12th man, as Rob said. But Rob, we must talk about Chimi Avila, because it's been a really rough couple of seasons for him. But he's back, he's fit, he's shown what he can do in pre-season, and he's set to be very important for his side this season.
Yeah, he's undoubtedly the star of the team. Generally, they bring the players through their academy, their cantera. But this is a young man who's come in from Argentina. He was a sensation in his first season. He scored 11 goals in 22 matches, 13 in all competitions. And then he scored 7 in 8, picked up a nasty knee injury the season before last, made a bit of a comeback, and then last September picked up a horrific knee injury as well. But we're told he's back, he's fit, and they hope that he's firing. If they're going to have any success at all, they need to get Chimi, as he's known to the supporters, back out there. And I mean, he's a wonderful player. He's an entertainer, as you can see from the boots and see from the hairstyle. He's a bit of a maverick.
Yeah, Kike's in as well. Borough fans will know that. Hopefully it lasts a bit longer than it did for Pollock there, with Kike coming in of Eibar and Borough fame. And as Rob said, lots of players who came through the cantera who really are the crux of the team. But Stevie, you've even got your own experience of this ground.
You two, you whippersnappers. I played in that ground in 85, I believe.
Did anybody give you a sandwich as well? Like, Kay got his sandwich?
But they were very friendly. They gave me a couple of beers after the game.
Very nice.
Yeah, we had a great couple of days there.
Maybe you didn't have a Real Madrid TV cue on your microphone.
That's
where it
went
wrong. I don't even think I did. I think we had to take it off as a precaution. But
really?
They heard us talking and realised. So you had a nice experience.
I had a fantastic experience, yeah. The people in the town were great. The fans were great. You know, when you were talking about they are the 12th man, well, this was a player of ours called Sammy Lee. It was his testimonial. He'd moved there and we went and played. We had a great time. Nice little break it was.
A wonderful time. But they didn't do the running of the bulls. If you've ever seen the running of the bulls in Pamplona, that is exactly where this happened. So anyway, that's Osasuna for you. Maybe that could be the team that you adopt if you're looking to choose one in La Liga this season. It kicks off very soon. Make sure you catch all of those games here on ESPN. It is available daily as ESPN FC. We'll be talking many more La Liga teams as the days roll on. Tomorrow, it is the champions, Atletico. Don't miss it. Gavin Jules back after a hiatus, although it's going to be Stuart Robson and Jules. Gab's still on vacation.
Gab's still on holidays.
They'll be talking about all these leagues and so much more, and no doubt where Gab's gone on vacation. That is the latest from us here at ESPN FC.
Gab is the most holidays.
Yep, Gab has the most holidays.
Really?
Gab has the most holidays.
What is that? The pot and the kettle?
Yeah, I think so.
No idea.
Join us for extra time. These two, Rob Palmer, not Rob Palmer, Ian Dark will be with us. Welcome into the latest edition of Extra Time. Kate Murray, Stevie Nicol, Shaka Hislop and Ian Dark are with you. We're giggling because we've been singing before we've come to air. Stevie's been singing and telling all sorts of jokes, maybe for another show. Let's get started with your questions. Rocky would like to know, and I'll ask you, Shaka.
If Jorginho wins the Super Cup and the Club World Cup, will it be fair for him to win the Ballon d'Or after already winning the Champions League and the Euros?
Right now, Messi's got to score 25 own goals between now and December to not win it. It doesn't really matter what Jorginho does at this point.
He'd have Lewandowski before him as well.
I feel like we talk about the Ballon d'Or a lot here. Where do you stand on this one, Mr. Dark? Jorginho as a Ballon d'Or winner?
Well, I mean, it's amazing because a couple of seasons ago, he was being ridiculed by Chelsea fans. They didn't like him when Maurizio Sarri was the manager, and he was the pantomime villain. Now he's the guy that's won the Champions League and the Euros. So I think he's in the conversation for the Ballon d'Or, but I don't think he'll win it.
OK. Abid says, Kay, can you ask Stevie who from Chelsea would get into Manchester United's best 11, including Sancho and Varane? I see only Mendy, Kante and James. 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 Reece James.
Mendy would get in. Arguably Mason Mount was better than anybody else as far as the whole season was concerned. Yes, other players did well, but he was the most consistent. He would get in it for me. Jorginho would get in it. Would you have Havertz over Cavani?
Nah, I wouldn't. I'd have Cavani.
But who's going to play more games? Cavani's not going to be able to play.
We're playing one game. We're playing one game for all the marbles.
So we're just picking for one game.
It's a Champions
best
League
team.
Final.
Right. Well, then.
I have Cavani.
Well, but see, we're all assuming that. Listen, I think Sancho's a great player.
Right.
But we're all assuming that Sancho's going to be this wonder kid or a superstar, which he's not far off it, but he's been a superstar with Borussia Dortmund. There's been a lot of superstars at Borussia Dortmund that have come to the Premier League, and Man United in particular, and bombed. So we're kind of assuming, and by the way, Sancho never got a game for England either in the Euros. So we're kind of assuming.
He got one.
Right.
But Grealish didn't play too much either.
I'm talking my way through the team. So, but again, I suppose you'd have to go with Sancho, but as I said, it's not.
So added to that list of Mendy, Kante, and James, you've added Mount and Jorginho.
Right.
Mm. Okay. What about Azpilicueta? Consistency.
He's at the end of last season, you could visually see him, even on the television, with 20 minutes to go, holding on to his knees, breathing heavy. I mean, there's no question. Azpilicueta is beginning to. He's only 31, which actually is quite young to be, in my opinion, the way he's looked at the end of the season. But he looked shattered to me, so I'm not sure I would put him in it.
Mason Mount looked a bit shattered in the Euros, to be honest with you, as well. I mean, he played 80 games between last summer and this summer, and I think it just took the edge off him. I was a bit surprised he kept his place in that England team. Great player, but just looked a bit tired, I thought.
Ian, I'm going to stick with you because Lee Catamol fan says, Ian, last year, halfway through the season, you said Arsenal would finish top four. How optimistic are you this season?
No, I don't think they're going to finish top four. And that was one of my worst predictions. And there have been quite a lot of bad predictions from me. But that's right up there, that one. No, I don't think they can get top four. The Ben White signing, as we've discussed today, I think is a good one, but they need more.
I love this next question from Sancho PR Winking Face. Shaka, I'm going to ask you all, actually. Shaka, who is the better striker between Ruud van Nistelrooy and Robin van Persie?
Oh, goodness me. I'm going to go Van Nistelrooy. I just feel Van Nistelrooy was the better finisher, no question. If I had to choose one between those two, I think I'd go Van Nistelrooy. I think I'd go the purer finisher.
Stevie, you're nodding?
Aye. Yeah.
Van Nistelrooy.
Van Persie is fantastic.
Yeah, there's no wrong answer.
But Van Nistelrooy is like just, you talk about just a pure goal scorer. Yeah. You think of Van Persie, you think of like top corner strikes for 20 yards and spectacular goals. Van Nistelrooy is just, hey, he can put it in the top corner,
yeah,
but he can also put it in his backside.
I think Van Persie was trickier around the box with the ball at his feet, but Van Nistelrooy just had that
more
slightly sharper striker's instinct. Just knew where to be and how to lose a defender.
And that was his nickname when he came to Real Madrid, was Killer. And Dan will remember the first season he came. As he got the ball, you knew it was a goal. Finished Pichichi in his first season there. Ian, you've obviously commentated on both of these players. Who is it for you?
Now, two great players, electric strikers, both of them. I think I go with the guys there. I think Ruud van Nistelrooy. It was good because he worked with us, didn't he? The World Cup in Brazil, I think it was.
Yep, 2014.
And you had this impression that he might be a bit difficult and a bit arrogant or something like that. But he was the most charming and modest man. So it was a pleasure to meet him as well. I think he did some ball juggling in the office with Steve McManaman and Michael Ballack. And they said to me, oh, come on, join in. I said, I'm not going to make myself look an idiot.
it's true what Ian says. He was actually a favourite among not just Real Madrid fans, but among the coaching staff and the backroom staff as well. Mm. And many of the journalists. He was a very nice guy. So a misconception that he wasn't
good,
a nice
guys.
Dan McLaughlin. Ian, how annoying is it to continue to watch teams concede on corners when a defender on the post could easily clear it?
Well, yeah, and we saw it today at the Olympic Games in the women's match. The GB, Great Britain team, played against Australia. Their first goal was a header that went straight in on the corner. Of course, Stevie will remember that every team used to have two fullbacks. I suspect he did the job himself once or twice on the line there for that exact thing. It's gone out of fashion now, but I've lost count of the number of goals I've seen and thought, you know what? Somebody on the line there would have just headed it away.
I bet you two have both got an opinion on this one, Shaka.
Huh?
About this question here. How annoying is it?
Stevie, I've never seen somebody get so angry when a ball goes in right near the post as Stevie. It doesn't matter who we watch it. If the ball goes in right off the post, Stevie's fuming. I totally agree. When I played, we always had somebody on the post. Just made sense.
And what Darkie says makes it worse, because that's all it is. Mm. Out of fashion.
Yeah.
Forget common sense. Forget the right thing to do. Forget something that works. But it's out of fashion. Well, we can't do that. We don't put players in the post anymore. So we're certainly not going to do it.
I've just seen that Twitter handle. Shaka Hislop's Newcastle jersey.
Oh, I missed it, didn't I?
Yeah, let me tell you.
I tried to ignore it, didn't I?
I had some shit.
Another thing, guys. Another thing that's gone out of fashion is corner kicks. How many do you see that are cleared easily by the first defender? The old idea where you've got a forward across the line of that corner kick, got the flick on. I mean, Arsenal did it all the time. They were famous for it. Steve Bold, I think, used to do it. Flick it on, somebody score with the header on the back post or in the 6-yard box. People don't do that anymore. They take corners and usually the first defender heads it away and that's that.
That was a classic Stoke. Every single time Stoke got a corner or a throw-in, they stuck the biggest, tallest, biggest square head and just put it right there. And you could have three and four around them and nobody could stop them from getting the flick on. So it all became about the second ball.
Mm.
Everybody knew what they were going to do, but it worked.
And you can't do anything about it.
I can, but you can't do that now. No, that's old-fashioned. You can't do it. Forget it works. Forget it's an absolute nightmare, by the way, for opposing coaches to defend against it. Because it's old. Honestly, I've got steam coming out of my ears. It drives me insane. All that
people,
stuff.
People can't find the biggest, tallest, biggest meathead anymore.
Yeah. There you go.
Shaka, then, let's get to this one. Shaka Hislop's Newcastle jersey. Stevie, what's the percentage of tactics versus player ability?
Oh, Bunny and Don Hutchison or something.
For a successful team, is it closer to 60-40 or 50-50?
Now, let me look at the question.
Percentage of tactics versus
tactics over ability.
Ability.
Oh, give me ability every day.
How much?
I'll tell you what, I could be the greatest tactician in the world, right? How am I going to stop Messi?
Well, Atletico Madrid won the league last year.
Oh, sorry, Messi's like nearly 60 years old.
No, it's all right.
You know what I mean? How do you stop Messi? With your tactics. People have been trying to stop Messi with the tactics since he was, what, 18?
Well, they have now and again, not often. There have been somewhere they've been.
Oh, now and again. Well, there you
Messi.
Go. You're just making my answer even more correct.
Okay.
You're saying now and again. Now and again, it just might have been he was having an off day. So, no question. Ability every single time over your tactics.
What percentage? Where's the spread?
60-40 or 50-50? Oh.
Give me
90-10.
Give me ability 80-20. All day. I'll say 80-20.
There you go.
Because at least you need a bit of brains.
Why do you have to get so angry for that?
That last question's got me wound up.
I know, he's still fuming.
Does me head on.
Still fuming. I, Juancho, tweets. For Shaka Hislop, do you prefer to make a great save in the air or nutmeg an oncoming forward?
I've never nutmeg an oncoming forward.
In real life.
So I'll have to go with save in the air because I don't know the other one. I don't know what that feels like.
Shaq, what kind of goalie were you landing, right? Did you land softly or did you land hard?
Oh, I was a soft lander.
Soft. Because we had a guy at the Reds, Aidan Brown was his name.
Yeah.
I think Aidan was about 6'4".
Right.
But I'll tell you what, you know when he landed, you could hear it a mile away and the ground shook. And he always got up like that. Oh, God. Every single time. Like an elephant hitting the deck every single time.
I'll tell you what, I remember back end of my career, I was saying to Brad Friedel, like, when I dived, I could feel every bone in my body shake. Right. And then I remember a few years later, Brad called me up and said, remember what you said? I know what you mean now. When you get to that age, it hurts. It does.
Speaking of things that hurt, Shaddy says, question for Stevie, what would hurt more? Scotland losing to England 10-0 or England winning in the World Cup?
Whoa!
England winning the World Cup. Easy.
Right.
Easy. Not even close.
But if it was Scotland against England 10-0, you'd never hear the last of that. England could win the World Cup against anybody else.
Oh, no. Well, put it this way. 1966 was the last time you won it, and we're still hearing about it. So, eventually 10-0 disappears.
Go on,
disappears.
Ian.
Stevie, I've got a question.
Yeah.
Did you go out and play golf when England were playing in the European Championship final because you couldn't bear the idea that England might win the Euros? Dennis Norden, in 66.
Well, if I'd had the choice, I would have golfed, but unfortunately, I had to watch it for the show. But I'll tell you what,
it broke your heart.
But you want to see me jumping when that last penalty got missed? I was like that. Yeah, it's not coming home. It's not coming home. It's not going home.
No, it was going to Rome. Very, very funny, says Shaka. Have you ever dreamt of what your testimonial match would be like? Opponents, teammates to invite to play, etc., etc.
No, I've never been anywhere that long enough to even come close. I think I was at West Ham for a total of 5 years. That was four my first spell, one the second. After that, 3 years everywhere else. I haven't even come close to that testimony.
That's a shame.
I'd have Stevie. How about that?
Yeah, what if you did have to put a team together of your best teammates?
Hold on.
And your favourite
players? I've been at ESPN for more than 10 years.
Go on, then.
I should have a testimonial game.
And a wonderful commentator to call it as well.
That's right. Ian will be on the same team with Steve McManaman, Ballack and Van Nistelrooy. Can't go wrong there.
Ian Colbain.
I'll tell you what, they did. Shaka Hislop, I've got to tell you, Shaka Hislop is very fondly remembered because I'm a Portsmouth fan. I think people know that. He's very fondly remembered at Fran Park and Pompey.
Thank you very much, Ian.
I'd love Shaka to have a testimonial game at Fran Park, and I think a lot of people would turn up. And I might even turn up myself.
God, you're in. You've already picked. Ian, you're in. You start the lineup.
Let's make it happen. Once restrictions are loose,
all right,
we're all heading to Portsmouth for Shaka's testimonial. Maybe you can join us there.
That is it for the latest edition of Extra Time. Stevie's still fuming about that question on Corey.
No, that question cheered me up about England losing.
ESPN FC, available daily. Don't miss it.